this podcast a little bit. I don't know if we're allowed to talk shit about Netflix, but there was a show that was about autistic adults dating and, I guess, being zoo animals and displaying that they have less social skills than other quote-unquote normal people. So that this podcast is a response to that. And I think our tagline right now is autistic people fuck.
Yep.
And we're here to talk about that and, tell you all the reasons how and why that's true in our lives, in the lives of our listeners and our friends, and in the lives of our guests, when we eventually do invite people on the podcast. And we are going to be structured. We're going to have guests. We're going to take questions, give advice, hopefully not lead these people astray. But we're also going to fuck around and have fun.
Absolutely.
Because the two of us, as autistic people, we love to perform. We love to talk to each other, talk to our partners, entertain in our lives and on the internet and on stage. And I think this is a really good way to showcase that and to give autistic people something honest, something funny, and something that makes them feel like they're a part of this, I guess.
100%. And, you know, we, Charlie and I discussed this in a private conversation when we were pitching the, you know, what we wanted this show to be about to one another. And I brought up something that, you know, friend of the show and must follow on Twitter, Nicole Cliff, said about this particular Netflix program, Love on the Spectrum, which is that, you know, the show talks a lot about how to essentially train yourself not to talk about trains to a potential partner, but it doesn't really talk about how great it is to find a partner who actually wants to hear about trains. And absolutely, we are the show for people who want to find a partner who wants to hear about trains.
Yeah, and I'm sure we're going to delve into our special interests because we both have them, and we have shared special interests, which are making fun of Boston, making fun of Italians, and cringing at electoral politics.
Oh, God. If we had done this a little earlier, we could have gotten when I was covering the Democratic National Convention and when, you know, that we had that viral moment with the big plate of calamari representing Rhode Island. We almost had the intersection of all three of those.
Oh my God, that would have been incredible, but hindsight and timing.
Yeah, that chef who insists that he is entirely apolitical actually follows me on Twitter. He seems like a really nice guy. So,
oh, good.
Which is good, you know. I am sick of both the asshole TV detective and the asshole TV chef. We need more nice chefs. Well, for those of you who may not have had the context for the chirping that we're hearing on your end, you want to tell us a little bit about Paris?
Oh yeah, Paris. Paris is the greatest thing to almost come out of this pandemic. I moved into a studio apartment on Christmas Eve of 2019, and for all of January, I was so lonely. I was doing so poorly. And then February 1st, I bought a cockatiel. And here he is. And he's so happy. And we're so happy. And we've just been locked up 24/7 because of COVID. And I mean, I already have existing chronic illnesses, and you know, I may or may not be a shut-in, while also being a working artist. So we're just in our face, in each other's faces, 24/7. And he is perfect. And I give him, so many gifts all the time. I give him, roses and mint and eucalyptus. And I recently gave him some mini pumpkins because it's gourd season, and he was terrified. He was so scared. He was like a child in the 1930s, just like afraid of, you know, jack-o'-lanterns and, you know, Frankenstein or Nosferatu or whatever the fuck. But he was terrified of these tiny, tiny 2-inch tall pumpkins. And then he conquered them. Then he started chewing on them and realizing that they're food. So we're good now.
We're proud of you, Paris.
We're so proud of you, Paris.
Hell yeah.
He's eating a hair tie right now.
And one thing that we had talked about that we also want to discuss at a later date is, you know, sort of tying in with the general theme of the podcast is just how valuable an animal companion can specifically be to an autistic person, and how, you know, really, especially during a time like this where you are basically stuck in the social arrangement that you found yourself in March or so, it can be like way more than a pet in terms of what it offers you in terms of companionship.
Absolutely. And he has gotten sick a couple times during this pandemic. And like, he's just so fundamental to my life. Like, I've had other things go wrong where, you know, my medications aren't right, my computer broke, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing compares to, you know, my partner in crime, best friend / son / parent. He's a little bit of a parent to me. Nothing compares to him, you know, being at less than optimal health. You know, I've had so many meltdowns about him, and that's kind of, you know, he is a sickly boy, and that's why I just get him gifts constantly, because he is my little, you know, mini god. He rules my life, and right now he's being very noisy with the bell. Pets are such an essential thing to autistic people, because, you know, despite what the larger narratives are out there, that we don't have empathy, we can't love, we can't maintain eye contact, we can't touch our loved ones, you know, animal companionship is just so essential for our well-being.
Absolutely. And, you know, I am going to pause here to note, our audience can't see this, but we're on a video call, so Charlie can, and I just want to make clear that my listening face involves people's eyebrow, and it might make it seem like I'm judging or something, and I just wanted to make absolutely clear that I'm not, because, you know, first and foremost, you know, this is gonna try to be a judgment-free zone in general, but also, I absolutely understand what you're saying, and, you know, we have two rescue cats, two big dumb couch cushion cats, and I don't know where we would be without them, Rachel and I, because as much as we love each other, you know, their ridiculous selves, I feel like, really ground us, and, you know, make it, you know, even if we are in shitty mood, we always feel like almost like into the woods, children will listen, and we got to set a good example for our big, dumb, constantly hungry children. And that really has, I really think that has helped with our relationship, with us, you know, not saying anything that we can't take back. Particularly,
do you think that your cats are like almost buffers? I don't want to say buffers because that makes it sound like there's like conflict, but, you know, just having two other beings in the house and playing off of your cats. Does that help sort of like keep things nice and smooth?
Partly, and it's weird that, you know, we have had to move with them several times, and, you know, I really feel like there's a sense between us that, you know, a partner that you move to misbehaving indoor cats with is someone you better be with for the long haul, because that is a real bonding experience. When we moved to our current house and were vacating our apartment, I just remember that we took the cats last, and they had been freaking out as the apartment slowly emptied, and so we were driving them. It was only about 20-25 minutes in these little carriers, and they were freaking out inside them, but they weren't like yowling or anything. They were just making this like really plaintive, mournful sound that sounded like yo, yo. And we felt really bad for them, but at the same time, the onomatopoeia of it has become sort of like an inside joke with us, and we will occasionally just go yo to one another when we're in that mood where, you know, we're feeling kind of sad, but we are ready to sort of make a joke out of it.
Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah, I guess yes is the short answer to your question.
That actually reminds me that I'm kind of a nightmare Tinder date, I think. And I actually did like have a Hinge date that I brought back to the apartment early on in having Paris, and of course before the pandemic and everything locked down. And Paris needs to hear my voice, so he will make peeps and he expects me to make peeps back. And so we'll just like have this feedback loop of peeping at each other. And you know, at that time I wasn't sure how to have guests in our space. So I was just like so obsessed, of course, with my bird and this guy who, you know, graciously ordered Uber Eats, was just sort of like, I don't know, like a blanket or a prop, something else on my bed. But, you know, Paris was the real star. Like, I was hanging out with Paris.
Hell yeah. And it actually makes me think of, Rachel was saying the other day, you know, she had read that the actual meow sound that's cats just make those for the benefit of humans. And when they're actually talking to each other, they'll just make those like little weird chirpy noises. And our girl Tabby Tessie makes those noises to Rachel all the time. And so she really feels a sense of companionship with Tessie, because she is, you know, she essentially treats her as mama cat when she does that.
Aww.
But yeah, so as we were, we've started and stopped recording this a few times for the benefit of the audience, but our future episodes will be more structured than this. This is mostly, largely a dry run, and it is sort of, we felt like really important to, you know, most of Charlie and my communication over the years has been online. And so we just wanted to take a little time to sort of establish the rapport and the sort of, I guess, chemistry, for lack of a better word, for riffing purposes that we have in a setting where we're actually talking to one another. So that's another reason that this was important to us to do an intro episode. And
I'm so sorry Paris is so loud. That's gonna be a theme. That's not going away with structure.
Yeah, yeah. You know, again, anyone who is listening to this and anyone who's gonna be talking to us, I feel like they understand the essential nature of someone like Paris, and you know, so I figure they're, you know, they are getting what they paid for.
He's a co-host.
Hell yeah. If we ever get mascots, if we ever get t-shirts or anything, there will definitely be a little cartoon Paris on them.
Yeah, someone did actually make me fan art of Paris for our joint birthdays, because we're both Cancers, and that's sort of like what really confirmed that I needed to get him. And so many people have you know, drawn him and paid tribute to him in various ways. And yeah, we did receive fan art that we could probably use for something in the future.
Hell yeah.
We may not be formally qualified to give life advice. We're not therapists. We're not like couples counselors. But I firmly believe that autistic people are the authorities on our own lives. And I'm going to say that again, because Paris was calling out to people walking below. We're not experts, but in the sense of... Stop! Okay, I need our editor to leave this in, because he's just being so difficult. Autistic people are the experts on our own lives. Things like Love on the Spectrum take that autonomy away. And the phenomenon of autism parents in general, where they are the ones who are beleaguered, and they are also the ones who are somehow experts and feel emboldened to shout the rest of us down. You know, we have so much status quo to push up against. There really aren't narratives out there that involve autistic people being honest about sex. And, you know, the sort of tagline for this podcast that people have been volleying around on Twitter is autistic people fuck.
Yep.
And we do. We just do. Because we're people.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that a lot of the time people don't understand that, you know, there is a, not even a particularly fine line, I think it's a particularly broad line between the idea that, you know, there is this big difference that we've got going on and the fact that, you know, we are still, you know, full human beings. Like, I mean, am I making sense? Again, this episode is largely us feeling things out, but you know, it's important for people to understand that, you know, it's not, we are not just like everybody else, but that does not mean that we are beyond your comprehension, especially if we're taking the time to explain ourselves like we are doing with this very podcast.
Yeah, and furthermore, I think there is an assumption about an inability to consent, which I'm sure, you know, we can dedicate multiple episodes to, because there's this fucking narrative that we are perpetual children. And, you know, with Love on the Spectrum interviewing people's parents about their love lives, it's just such a violence, honestly, to treat us like we are only children, and that's, you know, all we're ever gonna be. You know, personally, I wasn't raised knowing that I'm autistic. No one had any idea. So my experience of dating while autistic, you know, started kind of consciously at like 23. You know, I wasn't being told like, oh, you know, quiet hands, you need to do eye contact to relate to other people, that sort of thing. I just had to, I don't know, go through any other adults sort of journey of knowing who I am and how to advocate for myself.
Sure, sure. And I, you know, I think that autism isn't all we are, obviously, but it's a big part of who we are. And I think that one of the most, you know, empowering things a person can have is to know a big chunk of who they are. And, you know, that's a lot of things you can just figure out from there if you are empowered in that way. And I think that, you know, by the time I met my wife when I was 18 or 19, I knew that I was autistic, and I was able to be upfront with her about that. And, you know, I think that a lot of things about me took some getting used to for her, but I think that, you know, maybe understanding that about me led her to give me more of a chance than she might have otherwise. You know, obviously now we are, I've been told, disgustingly adorable. And, you know, that had to start with one of us, well, with both of us giving the other a chance. And, you know, I'm really grateful for that. And I'm really grateful that I was in a position to self-advocate to the point where, you know, I could put her in a position to give me a chance.
Yeah, and I think that everybody is weird, and everybody has to adjust to a partner's weirdness.
Sure, sure. And, you know, this is, you know, to be clear, we're doing this, you know, specifically for, you know, autistic and neuroatypical people, but I absolutely think, you know, probably there are a lot of neurotypical people who can learn something from listening to us. And, you know, even if they can't, we've been listening to them tell us our business for however many years. So turnabout is fair play, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we're able to impart sort of the emotional intelligence we've had to learn. And in some cases, maybe we are a little more conscious about our communication with others because we've had to actually intentionally work at it. Whereas neurotypical people, you know, maybe have absorbed social scripts and social mores a little more passively.
Yeah, 100%. You know, it's, and I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, it's almost like that. The metaphor I would use is almost like inherited wealth versus, you know, we're like these little like kids in Horatio Alger books. That's my first of many deep cut references. Hopefully these scrappy underdogs who hustled for everything they had. And it's just that what we're hustling for is social skills.
Yeah. And I'm not going to say I'm better than people who aren't autistic, but also I am.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the, for anybody listening, that is the official editorial position of the STEM for STEM podcast. Mm-hmm.